Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, it's important to keep moving as you get older, and everyone wants to stay independent for as long as possible. But what about driving? Even states have different laws when it comes to older drivers. For many families, it comes down to the children making the decision to take away the keys. We'll hear more on that topic. In Chicago, more food deliveries are being done by robot, and there are some concerns. The federal government is making it harder for immigrants to obtain legal status. We'll talk with an advocacy group about the changes. Illinois schools have fewer students. We'll find out the impact on local districts. This Week in Illinois History looks back at a rock band from the state that has achieved worldwide fame. And a classical musician is playing at a high level while juggling the responsibility of being a mom. Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, if it seems you're seeing more older drivers on the roads these days, you may be right. Americans are keeping their driver's licenses longer than ever before. In some cases, too long, according to safety advocates. But many older drivers say they should not be forced to give up mobility simply due to age. Joel Rose reports.
In June of last year, Angela Zudrow got the phone call every parent dreads from her husband, John.
He just said, Emmett's been hit by a car.
At first, Zudrow didn't grasp what was happening. The family lives in Green Lake, a small, postcard-ready resort town in Wisconsin, where kids ride their bikes all the time without a second thought.
He called back, and he said, you need to get here. And I was like, really? Okay. Is it bad? He said, yeah, it's bad. I said, is he breathing? And John said, I don't want to lie to you.
12-year-old Emmett Zudrow was riding his bike on the sidewalk near the public library, one of his favorite places, when he was accidentally run over by a minivan driven by Jean Woolley. Woolley was 85 at the time. She told police in Green Lake that she had confused the brake and gas pedals, as you can hear in this body cam footage of her statement released to NPR.
I was just pulling into this parking place, and I put the brake on, and it was the accelerator. Okay. And then I panicked and pushed it harder.
Woolley's lawyer called the crash a tragic accident, but declined to comment further, citing potential litigation. Woolley was not charged with a crime, though she did receive multiple citations and fines. 9 months later, Angela Zudrow still talks about her son in the present tense, like he might walk through the front door after baseball practice, a confident, outgoing kid with a big smile and bright blue eyes.
Emmett loves life. If there's one thing you say about Emmett, he loves life.
Since the crash, Zudrow and her family have been pushing to change the law in Wisconsin, where older drivers can go 8 years without having to renew their driver's licenses.
We're letting them just renew their driver's licenses without any checks on them. If you say you're fine, we believe you're fine. That needs to change.
There is no single national standard when it comes to older adults and driving. Each state sets its own rules for how often people have to renew their licenses and what kind of tests, if any, they have to pass. Many older Americans depend on driving for mobility and independence. And experts on aging say it's not easy to find the right balance between safety and fairness.
There's no simple answer. We have to be careful not to overreact, because it's not every older driver.
Ann Dickerson is an expert on older drivers at East Carolina University. She says it's hard to put an exact age on when older drivers should have to face additional testing to renew their licenses, because people are living longer and aging better than ever before.
You know, when I started, like 20 years ago, I would have said, oh, you know, 70, we have to start doing testing.
But Dickerson says crash rates for older drivers have declined since then. Now, for people without dementia or serious medical conditions, she says she might wait to start extra testing until 80 or later.
The research has shown people between 70 and 79 are actually pretty safe. They have really come down from crashes. Now, part of it's decreased risk, because they're not going to work every day. They self-restrict. That's not the age to go after.
There was a push to tighten the rules around relicensing, starting about 20 years ago. Some states made it easier for relatives, police, and doctors to report potentially unsafe drivers. Some added mandatory vision testing or more frequent visits to the DMV to renew licenses in person. But many states still don't require any of that. And lately, states have been moving to dial back their requirements, including Illinois, which has probably the toughest rules in the country.
The right to drive should be based on ability, not age.
That's Philippe Largent, the state director for AARP Illinois, speaking last year at a press conference to introduce the Road Safety and Fairness Act, a new law that takes effect in Illinois this summer. Republican State Representative Jeff Kiker is one of its co-sponsors.
Seniors should not be subjected to additional licensing requirements just because they had a birthday. It's an ageist policy, and it needs to be thrown out.
Kiker heard complaints from constituents who found the rules too restrictive. Illinois is the only state that requires seniors to take a behind-the-wheel driving test in their 70s. The new law does not eliminate that test completely, but it will raise the age when it's required to 87, while also making it easier for family members and others to report unsafe drivers of any age. Illinois is not the only state that has loosened its relicensing rules in recent years.
Every state has some kind of licensing policy that affects older adults, but we don't really have good evidence behind those policies. Are these things really working? Are they not strict enough?
Kara Hammond studies road safety at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. She noticed that some states are allowing more time between license renewals, in part to save money and because no one wants to spend more time at the DMV. Hammond wondered how those changes were affecting road safety, so she looked at the data, and what she found troubled her.
We are seeing increases in injury rates and crash rates with some of these policies loosening. Maybe not across all age groups, but among the ages that probably we're most worried about, you know, among the older drivers, that's what we found.
Hammond's research looked at two decades of data from 13 states and more than 19 million drivers who were involved in crashes. Seven of those states loosened their relicensing policies during that time. And in those states, the study found an increase in crash rates among drivers between 65 and 74. Now, this is only one study. Hammond says there's a lot that's still not known about relicensing and safety. But she thinks there is room for improvement.
We license people really young, and you get licensed and then you stay licensed, basically. There's not really a lot of testing that happens to renew. Maybe you get a vision test. It's kind of crazy if you think about it.
At the same time, Hammond acknowledges that many older Americans have no good alternatives to driving, especially in rural areas where public transit and ride sharing are not viable for most people. But for Angela Zudrow, whose son was killed by an older driver, stricter relicensing policies are a reasonable price to pay.
Yes, maybe it is a little difficult or inconvenient. I'm sorry about your inconvenience. It's harder to live without my son.
Zudrow says she's trying to do what her son Emmett would want, to spare other families from the kind of pain hers is feeling. Joel Rose, NPR News, Green Lake, Wisconsin.
And while states put safeguards in place to try to stop risky drivers from renewing licenses, it often falls to adult children to decide when it's time to take the keys away from aging parents. Again, Joel Rose.
At first, Jacqueline Hamilton says she noticed little things. Her father was driving slower, taking a longer time to turn. Then, one night on the way home from a Christmas party, he drove onto a walking path instead of the road.
That was kind of the first red alert for me. I don't know if you remember that, Dad.
I remember everything.
Okay.
James Stubbs, Hamilton's father, loves to drive, even at 94. It was a big part of his job, selling fabric all over Minnesota and beyond. So Hamilton says it was painful to see his driving skills start to fade.
He's my dad. He taught me how to take care of my cars. And he taught us the road. He just taught us everything. So doing this was very hard.
Hamilton agreed to share her family's story. So we all sat down in her living room in West St. Paul, Minnesota. Hamilton says she talked to her father and tried to convince him that it was time to stop driving. He was not interested.
Tell me, when have I made a mistake in driving?
I listed them, Dad.
Hamilton was so concerned that she filed the paperwork to formally request a driver's exam for her father. That meant he would have to pass some tests, including a cognitive test, to keep his license. It did not go well.
He can't understand directions. He couldn't remember the day, year, the day of the week were all wrong.
Do you remember this test? Remember taking the test?
Oh, yeah, I remember the test. You the try them.
Yeah.
Come on, anyone you can try. I said, this is ridiculous.
The state DMV formally revoked Stubbs' driver's license, but he still had the physical plastic card, which didn't look like it had expired.
He still had that card. He could see the date on that card, and he wasn't going to give me the keys. No way.
Why would I?
Hamilton wasn't sure what to do until an opportunity presented itself a few months ago while her father was in the hospital and her mother was visiting.
And I happened to look in her purse and I saw both sets of keys. That was a pivotal moment. I could take the keys or I could not take the keys. The hard part was if I didn't take the keys, then anything that would happen after that point would be my fault. If they got into a car accident, it wouldn't be blood on their hands, it would be blood on mine.
States have a wide range of rules and policies for older drivers. Some require vision tests or more frequent visits to the DMV to renew licenses in person. In some states, doctors and police can or must report drivers they think are unsafe. But adult children and relatives say in reality, it often falls to them to make the hard decisions about the older drivers in their lives. NPR asked in an online call-out for your experiences with aging relatives and driving. We got more than 100 responses, and many shared similar stories about taking matters into their own hands.
We noticed the little dings and scratches all over the car. You know, every time you go up and visit them, like, wow, I don't remember seeing that last time.
Alan Cunningham lives in central Illinois, outside Peoria. Cunningham tried to talk his father into giving up driving in his mid-80s, but it just made his dad angry. Cunningham hoped his father's doctor would help make the case. That didn't work either. Then it was time for his father to renew his driver's license. In Illinois, that meant he had to take a driving test behind the wheel. But to Cunningham's surprise, his father passed.
It really comes back down to the family. Unless there's something obvious, it's really hard to get somebody else to do it. You know, you're really stuck doing it yourself.
Finally, Cunningham came up with his own solution to stop his father from driving. His parents kept their car keys in a rack near the door, so Cunningham replaced them.
We just left keys that did not work in the car, some old keys. And he'd see them and he'd think it was okay. At least he had the keys, he'd leave if he needed to, but he never did. And so that's kind of how we got by the last couple of years. It's just a difficult situation, but you do the best you can.
Some older adults give up driving voluntarily, but many are reluctant because they're afraid of losing their mobility and independence. And the emotional fallout from these situations can last a long time. Jacqueline Hamilton in Minnesota says her father is still mad at her for taking away his keys.
When he gets angry, at one point, one phone call, he just says, I hate you. And my response is, I love you. And he said, I hate you.
I asked Hamilton's father, James Stubbs, how he feels about this now.
Do you understand why she did it? Why she felt like she had to?
She felt like she had to. She didn't have to.
Still, Jacqueline Hamilton says she would do it all again.
I feel good about what I did. Hard. As it is, I did the right thing.
And Hamilton knew that no one else was going to do it for her. Joel Rose, NPR News, West St. Paul, Minnesota.
McDonough County in western Illinois might soon be without ambulance service, but the head of the McDonough District Hospital is hopeful something can be worked out, Rich Egger reports.
The hospital has contracted out the service with a lifeguard ambulance for around the past 8 years, but MDH President and CEO Bill Murdoch says the hospital has opted to end its contract with lifeguard effective May 3rd. The contract just went into effect on January 1st. Murdoch says the hospital signed the contract because it felt backed into a corner. They did not want the community to be without ambulance service. But finances are pushing them to reconsider.
MDH is in a precarious situation, being a rural independent hospital where we're financially challenged, and looking at all of our non-core services is really what's driving this.
Murdoch says the hospital is also closing its sleep lab and looking at other services that might not be a core part of the hospital's mission. He says the hospital still faces headwinds. It's operating at a deficit, and staffing shortages have been more common since the COVID-19 pandemic. He also says reimbursements are falling short. For example, Medicare is paying the hospital just 83 cents on the dollar.
I would say we're not stable yet. This is one of other things we're considering to get stable so we can be here as an independent hospital for a long time.
There is still time between now and May 3rd to prevent the loss of ambulance service. Murdoch would like the city of Macomb and the county to help out financially.
We like for community leadership to step up and own it, and we'll partner with them on that.
Murdoch says the hospital has been in touch with another ambulance service that they had not talked to previously, and MDH is awaiting their contract proposal. In addition, he says Lifeguard is open to renegotiating their contract, and they'll be submitting another proposal. Rich Ecker reporting.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargow.
I want you to want me.
No fooling. On April 1st, 2007, the Illinois General Assembly passed Senate Resolution 255, designating every April 1st in Illinois as Cheap Trick Day. World-famous rock band Cheap Trick hails from Rockford, where in the late 1960s, guitarist Rick Nielsen and bassist Tom Peterson formed the band Fuse. They toured the Midwest before recruiting drummer Bun E. Carlos. In 1974, they added vocalist Robin Zander, and Cheap Trick was born. They signed with Epic Records in 1976, but their self-titled debut album earned mixed reviews and lackluster sales. Then a 1978 tour of Japan and the live album recorded there launched the band to international stardom. In their nearly 50-year history, they've sold over 20 million albums, performed over 5,000 live shows, and earned 40 gold and platinum awards. Cheap Trick's monumental success has never severed their connection to their home state or their hometown of Rockford. On April 8, 2016, Cheap Trick was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Here's singer Robin Zander after the ceremony.
I was born in Rock County. I grew up in Rockford, Illinois. I lived on the Rock River. And now I'm in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So I think it was predestined.
And that's This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargow.
We'll have more of Statewide in a moment. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A nonprofit that provides legal support for immigrants in central and southern Illinois is concerned the gutting of a federal program will add more barriers for immigrants to gain legal status. A news report says the Justice Department is halting its recognition and accreditation program, which dates back to the 1960s. It trains and certifies non-attorneys to provide legal aid for immigrants through nonprofit advocacy groups like the Immigration Project based in Normal. Danielle DeWinter is the Immigration Project's legal director. In this interview, DeWinter tells Eric Stock the action, which the DOJ has yet to confirm, could freeze the 30 DOJ reps that can help immigrant families.
It caused quite a bit of panic in my office, and, you know, I'm not sure how many clients know the difference between a DOJ rep and a legal aide, like on the face, until they're engaged with us and understand the process. But thankfully, I haven't gotten any direct client concerns, but we are trying to stay ahead of that. And so, yes, yeah, it caused some panic. Thankfully, as it stands right now, I should say, because things are constantly changing. But as it stands right now, as long as an applicant, both organization and individual, applies for renewal prior to their expiration of their current accreditation, their accreditation continues until a decision is made on that application. So it drastically impacts my folks who are applying new. But for individuals who are applying for a renewal, at least I'm not having to have a very serious conversation about capacity and shifting some of those existing cases within our office to others.
Is there any understanding why this happened?
Not to my knowledge. I think all of us can make some assumptions, but I have not been told any or researched anything directly as to why this is happening.
The initial report from CBS that raised this concern also included a report from a government official, unnamed, who said the program, quote, isn't ending or being abolished. It is a longstanding program established by regulation and will continue. So it sounds like it is, but in a almost skeleton form now.
It is. I mean, that is the thing, is that is accurate. It's in existence, but it's almost moot if no decisions can be made on new and existing applications.
How many immigrant families use this service in Central Illinois?
Oh, too many to count. There are multiple organizations throughout Central and Southern Illinois who have DOJ reps on their staff.
What other options might they have? Are you able to find them help through other means?
I mean, thankfully, part of the conversation yesterday with other partners throughout the state was talking about existing state funding applications. So there's many notices of funding opportunities coming out within the next couple of weeks for state-funded programs that have been in existence. So access to justice, immigrant legal support programs, all of those. Both of those fundings fund DOJ-accredited organizations and therefore representatives. And one of the things we're trying to actively work with them on and be cognizant of as time progresses is, like, how are those funding sources going to be written to allow the flexibility depending on what these RNA, what happens with this RNA program. But the reality is there is going to be a huge gap of services if this program does not continue to proceed and adjudicate applications.
Yeah, what will the fallout of that be?
Individuals will not be represented. It's going to cause serious problems within the immigration system. It's already an extremely complicated process, and it's going to have more individuals who are now working through that process without the proper knowledge of the system itself. It's going to cause delays for the government. So it's a benefit to the government to have individuals represented. It's going to, again, like I said, it's going to mean a lot of underrepresented individuals, and it's going to be an increase in fraud of individuals who are not experienced, who are not trained, helping vulnerable immigrants, as it is, to go through this extremely complicated process.
As we continue with Danielle DeWinter from the Immigration Project, this would seem to make the immigration system more clogged than it already is.
Absolutely.
How clogged is it now?
Very clogged. I mean, so many applications are taking an obscene amount of time. Individuals throughout the court process with EOIR, who are filing affirmatively, which means they are not actively in removal with USCIS. I mean, applications are taking years to have decisions being made. And this is only going to slow things down even more.
One point when the Trump administration was asked, how were you going to deport however many millions out of the U.S., and one point they said was, there will be a lot of self-deportation. Is this an effort to boost self-deportation then?
I believe so. And we're seeing that. We're seeing that, unfortunately. We're seeing that in the Immigration Project, as well as in partnership with other organizations, specifically through the ARMEDA Alliance, the Midwest Immigrant Defenders Alliance, is seeing the need for more and more habeas cases. Habeas cases are actually outside of the immigration system, but a tool for the immigration system, which brings us into federal court. So again, the more delays that the immigration process is establishing, it's not just impacting our immigration system, it's going to impact our federal court system as well.
That's Danielle DeWinter from the Immigration Project. She spoke with Eric Stock. DeWinter also says she's closely watching the current fight in Washington over funding for immigration enforcement that is behind holding up an agreement for a Homeland Security budget. DeWinter says she and her staff are not getting involved in that fight because she's concerned about staff burnout from all the ongoing political fights over immigration. Most Chicago voters were against last September's federal deportation campaign, Operation Midway Blitz. That's according to a new survey that found most of those polled viewed Trump administration immigration officials negatively. It found a majority of Chicagoans also supported pathways to citizenship for immigrants. Here's Jason McGrath. He's a partner with the Democratic polling firm GBAO Strategies, which did the survey and asked broadly about immigration.
75% say it's a good thing. Just 14%, 1 in 7, say it's a bad thing. That's not just in the city. That is extended throughout the Cook suburbs and beyond, all the way throughout the entire market.
That poll was conducted in March. Illinois' public school enrollment is down 10% over the past decade. That's 200,000 fewer K-12 students. Peter Medlin reports on how that loss hits local school districts.
Why are you trying to shut down our schools? You are taking away my friends, and that makes me sad. I love my school.
Jessica Polhill reads a note written by her son, who's in elementary school.
Sorry? What are you doing to our schools?
It's at an emotional public forum a few months back when the Harlem School District was weighing whether it should shutter two elementary schools, Maple and Olson Park. And in January, the board voted to close them. Schools closing isn't super common, but it does happen. Data from the State Board of Education shows 72 public schools have closed in the past 5 years. And not all of them have boarded up completely. Some were repurposed, like an elementary school becoming a preschool. And one of the main reasons for closures in Harlem was enrollment. Administrator Jason Bloom says it peaked around 2007, and it's been downhill ever since, around 18% in the past two decades.
So we've known for a long time this is something that we need to do.
But why now? Well, declining enrollment is significant, but also significant is the district's projected $3 million budget deficit. That's why the schools will close after this school year. They need to cut costs now.
The projections that we had for this upcoming year definitely played into probably expediting this a little bit.
Unfortunately, when they talk about cutting costs, the savings doesn't come from just closing a building.
The money that we save when we close schools comes from the staff. Like, it's not the operations, it's not the necessary utilities.
Staff will lose their jobs, and it's not exactly clear how many yet. And some Harlem teachers say the process just moved too quickly. Early childhood teacher Katie Fowler says they heard their jobs might be on the chopping block at the same time as the rest of the public.
I think we were all pretty dismayed, yeah. It was, yeah, a lot of disappointment and a lot of frustration and just like lack of transparency.
It made a tough sell to the community. Even tougher. Closing any school is painful. Schools give a town or a neighborhood a sense of identity. It's where childhood memories are made. So this process is a science and an art. How do you explain why a tough decision like this is necessary in a way that maintains trust? Margot Empin knows about that. She's the superintendent at the Dixon School District, and in the face of enrollment declines, they closed down an elementary school 10 years ago, one she taught at.
There are still people who, you know, still feel it was not the right choice.
She says communicating with families during that time was crucial. And Dixon is still dealing with long-term enrollment declines. They've fallen about 14% since 2018, which is twice the state average. And Empin says for them, it's not an urgent five-alarm fire. It's something they monitor over years and try to get out in front of before it becomes an emergency.
What I would say is that we've been experiencing our smaller tweaks.
They also switched from having neighborhood schools, which means students mostly attend the elementary school closest to their house, to grade level centers, which means there's one school for second and third grade, one for fourth and fifth, and so on. You know, neighborhoods don't grow or shrink evenly across a town. So when you have neighborhood schools like Harlem, enrollment can fall a lot at some schools and not at all at others. In Harlem, Jason Bloom says they have some schools with class sizes of 16 and others around 25, and some schools that held 450 kids now hold 250. In the end, Harlem voted to keep their neighborhood school model because they heard over and over from families that the long-term connections made at those schools were too important to let go of. But Maple and Olson Park will still close this spring. And statewide, the enrollment decline problem is not going away, and neither are high costs. And Bloom says he thinks Harlem's just the first district in the area to bite the bullet, and that more and more districts could look at closing schools. In fact, in a few days, voters in Lamoille will be asked if they should close their high school. And the main reason? Enrollment. I'm Peter Medlin.
Governor Pritzker's proposed state budget for the next fiscal year calls for little new funding, but Rich Egger tells us advocates for higher education want the state to invest more in its public colleges and universities, and they'd like to see that done now.
Specifically, they want the state to increase its investment in the Monetary Award Program, also known as MAP grants, and they want lawmakers to pass an equitable funding formula for higher education. Merrill Cole is president of the Western Illinois University chapter of the University Professionals of Illinois, which represents faculty at Western.
It doesn't matter whether the governor is Democratic or Republican. What we've seen in the state of Illinois for the last 23 years is a steady decline in state funding for higher education, and that needs to turn around now.
The Coalition for Transforming Higher Education Funding hopes to convince lawmakers to do that. It'll hold a Higher Education Advocacy Day in Springfield on April 16th. It expects to draw hundreds of advocates from across the state. Cole told Western's Board of Trustees that he's been working with the Provost Office, the Faculty Senate, and other groups on campus to make sure Western participates. Cole said he's been asked if it's the right time to do this, given the tight state budget and funding uncertainty from the federal government.
I would say no time is the right time to ask the state to cough up money. We just need to make this the moment when it happens.
Cole said the rally on April 16th is an opportunity for faculty, students, and staff to stand up and pull together. Zach Messersmith said adequate and equitable funding is a vital issue for Western, and he said most of the state's public universities are working together on the issue.
It really is impactful when we all are together pulling the same direction.
Messersmith, who is Western's Director of Government and Public Relations, said there is one publicly funded university in Illinois that's not on board with the plan.
The University of Illinois system is still opposed quite vocally, and even though the University of Illinois Chicago would receive the most money overall.
Messersmith said the U of I has offered no counterproposal to the measure, which he called frustrating. Board Chair Polly Radosh said about 40% of Illinois high school graduates who attend college go to a university in another state. She believes more would stay in Illinois if tuition could be kept lower.
When they leave at that stage of their life, they're not going to be as committed to the state, to stay in the state. Sure. So it affects not only their education, but the outward migration of our citizens.
Radosh said she's from New York State, but her graduate school years were spent in Illinois. She became comfortable in Illinois during those years, so that's where she put down roots. Trustee Kirk Dillard said the estimated cost of the bill needs to be put in perspective.
It's $135 million out of a $56 billion state budget.
Dillard also said that a bachelor's degree remains valuable. He said someone who graduated with a bachelor's in 1979, like he did from Western, earned an estimated 38% more over their lifetime than someone without such a degree. He said today it's 85% more.
So why wouldn't the state of Illinois want to spend a mere $135 million in a $56 billion operation to essentially take up the income of the people of Illinois?
Dillard said those same people will spend that money back in income and sales taxes and boost the state's economy. Western's leaders say they have some allies in their push to pass the adequate and equitable funding bill. Its lead sponsor in the Senate is Majority Leader Kimberly Lightford. She's a Western alumna. Fellow Democratic Senator Mike Halpin is a co-sponsor. His district includes Western's Macomb and Quad Cities campuses. Rich Egger reporting.
We'll be back with more of Statewide in just a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Hair can be a lasting remembrance of a person who died. In Independence, Missouri, hair became much more. For nearly 40 years, a hair museum featured wreaths, jewelry, and other artifacts made from human hair. It closed in 2025, and reporter Julie Denishay reported the family was finding new homes for the hairy artistry.
From a small storefront on a busy street in Independence, Missouri, Lindsay Evans is on a mission.
Hey, hey. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. Come on in.
She's been in contact with museums across the country to find new homes for her grandmother's most treasured artifacts.
My grandmother always said there were one of two reactions when people came in the museum. And the first one was, oh my gosh, this is hair? Wow. The other was, this is hair? Oh my gosh. And they would kind of run the other way.
The 3,000-piece collection includes Victorian-era jewelry and around 1,000 delicately crafted wreaths, all made from human hair.
Some people have a little bit of an ick factor with it. It is an odd collection.
Evan says her grandmother, Leila Cahoon, who founded the museum in 1986, died last fall, and the museum closed in September. So for almost four decades, Leila's Hair Museum was what Cahoon called the world's largest collection of hair work.
They're absolutely gorgeous. From far away, you look at them and you just think, wow, that's a beautiful piece of art. And then you get close and realize that's hair. It's absolutely incredible.
Elaborate Victorian-era wreaths encased in shadow box frames once covered the walls. Creating them took months or even years to complete. Each tells a story, like the one of sisters in Sedalia, Missouri, who created a wreath when they entered a convent. A teacher in Maine crafted another from her students' hair. One wall was devoted to hair from icons like Elvis Presley, John F. Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, and Michael Jackson.
Packed safely away, ready to go.
Yes.
I love it. Okay.
Sarah Bader King stopped by to choose a few wreaths with local connections. She's curator at two of Kansas City's most historic structures, the John Warnell and Alexander Majors House Museums.
It just seemed like the perfect opportunity to, you know, help her keep things in Kansas City while also adding to our collection in a really substantial way.
It might work.
As word got out that the museum was closing, a flurry of visitors have come for tours. Karen Bachman is a professor of the history of jewelry at New York's Pratt Institute.
These things got shoved in attics and forgotten about. People would look and go, I don't even know whose hair that is. But when you appreciate it and you see it in a collection such as this, they're still remembered. They're still valued.
Listening to you talk, I feel like my grandmother's here again, because the things that you're saying are the things that she would tell people about these pieces. And so I love having people here who know and appreciate this art form as much as she did.
As Evans begins to wrap up the months-long process, she says she's grateful to share her grandmother's passion.
That's what she wanted for me, and it's helping me grieve in a way I didn't even realize I needed. And so I've loved that.
Evans said her grandmother wrote in a letter that she wanted her to share Leila's Hair Museum. Now she's hoping others around the country can learn more and appreciate the unusual artifacts that will now be located elsewhere. For NPR News, I'm Julie Denishay in Kansas City.
A growing number of food delivery robots are driving around Chicago's north and west sides. Can Chicagoans and bots share the sidewalks? Brandon Kondritz reports.
It was a drizzly Tuesday afternoon when I met Josh Robertson in Lincoln Park.
We took a walk around his neighborhood, and it wasn't long before we found a box on wheels, a food delivery robot. Robertson remembers the first time his family saw one.
It felt futuristic, kind of amusing.
Two food robot companies have come to town, Coco Robotics in 2024 and Serve Robotics last September. You may have seen them around. Coco's bots are pink and orange, and Serve's are green and white with blinking eyes. They certainly look futuristic. But Robertson says that novelty wore off the first time his family approached one on the sidewalk.
We at first pointed and chuckled, but as it got closer, we found ourselves feeling the need to step out of its way so that it could pass. And that immediately raised a lot of questions for me. What the effect of these robots might be for Chicagoans of all stripes.
Chicago City Council passed a so-called personal delivery device pilot program in 2022. It allows these robots to make short-distance deliveries using sidewalks and crosswalks. Robertson wanted to know if other people had concerns about the robot's impact on sidewalk accessibility and on jobs for people who deliver food. So he launched a petition calling on the city to pause the bots until after a public hearing. It's gotten nearly 4,000 signatures. He read me some of the submissions.
Wouldn't move out of the way for me and my grocery cart. I have a mobility impairment requiring the use of crutches to walk. On more than one occasion, these robots stop in the center of the sidewalk as they approach me, not leaving enough room to safely walk around. The sidewalks are very icy right now, and I'm pregnant, so it's already hard to walk and avoid ice.
Serve CEO Ali Kashani said in an interview with WBEZ, the company's mission is to reduce the country's reliance on cars. He says deliveries are a good place to start, but he's aware of the pushback in Chicago.
We need to understand what the concerns are and try to learn from it as much as possible and improving the robots as much as possible. That's an ongoing process. It's people can reach out to us. Every email is responded to.
Serve has nearly 140 bots in Chicago. They live in a warehouse in Westtown.
Here is where we do all our maintenance, where we get our deliveries in.
That's Alex Nelson. He manages the fleet and gave me a tour. Every morning, his team loads about 75 bots into vans and drops them off around their approved service area. They can track them on deliveries throughout the day. And then at night, Nelson says his team brings them all back to charge. He grew up in the suburbs and has lived in the city for 15 years. So next to the rows of charging stations, I asked Nelson about what he thought of the argument that sidewalks are for people first, and about his response to the company's critics.
I'm never gonna not stop like hearing what those people have to say, but I also wanna make sure that like, if you're like, no, I don't want bots, period, okay, then that burrito that that bot is delivering is showing up in a car or a truck or something else. Like, are you okay with that?
What happens with the bots from here is unclear. The pilot program is managed by Chicago's Department of Transportation and its Business Affairs and Consumer Protection Office. BACP declined WBEZ's interview request. CDOT said in a statement that both offices review monthly reports from COCO and Serve, and that residents can submit feedback using 311. COCO said in a statement they want to make local delivery, quote, safer, more sustainable, and more cost-effective. Near the end of my walk with Josh Robertson, who's behind the petition, a Serve bot named Tahoe was driving toward us.
This part, this sidewalk is pretty narrow, and there are...
As we approached a pinch point between a light pole and a sandwich board, Tahoe got a little confused.
It's very challenging to pass. It's just waiting for us to go around. And so my choices are either to step dangerously close to the street, to back up and let the robot pass, or to stand here indefinitely, apparently.
So we stepped to the side, and after some starts and stops, Tahoe thanked us and was on its way.
That was illustrative of the kind of thing that I think a lot of Chicagoans now experience fairly often. Being in a standoff with the robot and having to defer, having to get out of the way or go around, potentially into more dangerous situations.
The pilot program won't continue past May 2027 without City Council approval. Brandon Kondritz, WBEZ News.
Emma Gerstein is a flautist with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. She's been touring with Extra Cargo. She recently gave birth to her second son. She's not alone in trying to juggle childcare and concert performances, and she filed this audio diary to show us what it's like to play at classical music's highest level with a 10-month-old in tow.
This is my first tour since having my second child, Ronan, and since I am still his primary source of food. He is joining me, along with my sister, who's gonna help me take care of him during the concerts, because my husband has to stay home with our older son. Other people have done it in the orchestra, brought their children, their babies, but I just haven't done it yet, so I'm sort of curious how it's gonna go.
We have a tour rehearsal today, and I'm just warming up a little bit, which is something that feels like a luxury these days. I'm very stressed about packing right now because even though it's only a week-long trip, there's always so much stuff to bring for a baby. Especially since having my second baby, I find it very hard to transition between sort of mom mode and working Emma musician mode. And just taking a moment to play some fundamentals right now. Just sort of trying to connect with that other part of myself that needs to be present at work. People keep coming up to me and saying that he seems so good-natured and yada yada, and that feels good because, you know, he does fuss a little bit on these buses, and it's like, it's not just being on a bus, it's like a coach bus with all of my colleagues, and I feel more stressed he might be bothering people that I work with. But it's hard when you have this kind of schedule and you have a baby. I miss my older son so much right now, even though I just saw him yesterday morning. And so being with Ronan right now, it just feels like extra time together. And I'm really just trying to relish in that because he's growing up so fast and he'll be one before I even know it. And then I'm just trying to enjoy the cuddles right now and the snuggles and the little baby noises and all of that, because I know that it's fleeting. The nature of our job is like, we can't just take breaks whenever we want. We have to take breaks at designated times. It does make the sort of mental math of like, okay, well, I fed him at this time and I'm gonna have this time to pump. So I need to just work with that. I also hope that that is improved because there was no place for us to pump. I ended up getting several clogged milk ducts, which extremely painful. I'm not gonna have any more kids, but I want other women to feel supported. I don't want that to be a reason why someone wouldn't be interested in joining. What do you think, Ronan? Getting on the elevator now. This whole, like, toggling back and forth between roles is still really getting to me, and now I have to quickly change my headspace again. I think from talking to other moms in the business, I think this is sort of normal. Sixth floor, lobby. There's this biological desire to be with my children and to be a mother. And there's also a need to work, you know, both literally and also just like, I want to work too. I enjoy my job. I love to play music. In my mind, I'm still like 27, and you know, I guess I'm not. Things have changed a bit. Tomorrow we will travel home to Chicago. Oh! I have sort of mixed feelings about going home. I'm mostly excited to go home. I'm excited to see Angus and just sleep in my own bed, have Ronan sleep in his own bed. But it has been, like, really nice to have all this time with him. I hope that my boys will see me doing something that I love and that that will enhance their lives and not take away from it, you know? To see their mother having a career that not only provides for our family but also
that makes me happy. I got home from Boston this morning. We had a great concert last night, great end of tour concert. I have a really great village. I feel very lucky. And Angus and Ronan are lucky. So I guess that's the end. And now I'm back to regular mom life, thinking about what's for dinner. But first, I'm gonna have a little quick rest.
The music courtesy of the Chicago Symphony Music Association. That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.